something done with a pen and paper, like Mozart. He'd never even heard of Mick Jagger when Chrissy first talked to him. We brought 7 lawsuits against Alan Klein over 17 years. And eventually it was a farce, with both sides waving and chatting in the courtroom, like a normal day at the office. So Rupert at least learned the jargon of the business, even if he never got emotionally involved in the music. It had taken us a while to discover what Alan Klein had helped himself to, in what wasn't ours anymore. We had a company in the UK called Nanka Felge Music, which was a company we all shared in. So we get to New York and sign this deal to a company into which everything is to be channeled henceforth, also called Nanka Felge, which we presume is our same company with an American name, Nanka Felge USA. Of course, after a while, we discovered that Klein's company in America bore no relation to Nanka Felge UK and was wholly owned by Klein. So all the money was going to Nanka Felge USA. When Mick was trying to buy his house on Cheney Walk, he couldn't get the money out of Alan Klein for 18 months because Alan was trying to buy MGM. Klein was a lawyer monkey. He loved the letter of the law, and he loved the fact that justice and the law had nothing to do with each other. It was a game for him. He ended up owning the copyright and the master tapes of all our work. Anything written or recorded in the time of our contract with Decca, which was to end in 1971. But it ended, in fact, with Get Your Yah-Yahs Out in 1970. So Klein owned unfinished and uncompleted songs up to the 71 limit, and that was the tricky part. The fight was about whether the songs between that record and 71 belonged to him. In the end, we conceded 2 songs, Angie and Wild Horses. He got the publishing of years of our songs, and we got a cut of the royalties. He still owns the publishing to satisfaction, too, or his heirs do. He died in 2009. But I don't give a shit. He was an education. Whatever he did, he blew us up the river. He put it together, although satisfaction certainly helped at that moment. I've made more money by giving up the publishing on Satisfaction, and my idea has never been to make money. Originally it was, do we make enough to pay for the guitar strings? And then later on, do we make enough to put on the kind of show we want to put on? I'd say the same about Charlie, and Mick too. Especially initially, hey, we don't mind making the money, but most of it's ploughed back into what it is we want to do. So the basic flavor of it is that Alan Klein made us and screwed us at the same time. Marshall Chess, who climbed the ladder from the mailroom to become president of Chess after his father died, had just sold the company and was looking to start a new label. Together we founded Rolling Stones Records in 1971, and made a deal with Atlantic Records to distribute, which is where Ahmet Ertegun came in. Ahmet, an elegant Turk who, with his brother Nesui, drove the music business into a total rethink of what it was that people could hear. The echoes of the Stones' idealism, juvenile as it was, resonated. Shit, I miss the mother. The last time I saw him was backstage at the Beacon Theatre in New York. Where's that fucking John? I showed him the way. He snapped the lock. I went on stage. After the show, I found out he'd slipped on the tiles. He never recovered. I loved the man. Ahmet encouraged talent. He was very much hands-on. It wasn't like an EMI or a Decca, some huge conglomerate. That company was born and built up out of love of music, not business. Jerry Wexler, too. It was a whole team, a family thing in a way. Need I go through the roster? Aretha, Ray, too many to mention. You felt like you joined the elite. But in 1970, we had a problem. We were in the ludicrous situation where Klein would be lending us money that we could never afford to repay because he hadn't paid the tax, and anyway, we'd spent the money. The tax rate in the early 70s on the highest earners was 83%, and that went up to 98% for investments and so-called unearned income. So that's the same as being told to leave the country. And I take my hat off to Rupert for figuring a way out of massive debt for us. It was Rupert's advice that we become non-resident, the only way we could ever get back on our feet financially. The last thing I think the powers that be expected when they hit us with super, super tax is that we'd say, fine, we'll leave. We'll be another one not paying tax to you. They just didn't factor that in. It made us bigger than ever, and it produced Exile on Main Street, which was maybe the best thing we did. They didn't believe we'd be able to continue as we were if we didn't live in England. And in all honesty, we were very doubtful too. We didn't know if we would make it, but if we didn't try, what would we do? Sit in England and they'd give us a penny out of every pound we earned? We had no desire to be closed down, and so we upped and went to France. Chapter 8, in which we leave for France in spring of 1971, and I rent Nell Cott, a house on the Riviera. Mick gets married in Saint-Tropez. We set up our mobile truck to record Exile on Main Street and settle into a prolific nighttime recording schedule. We motorboat to Italy for breakfast in the Mandrax. I hit my stride on the five-string guitar. Graham Parsons comes and Mick gets possessive. I insulate myself with drugs. We get busted. I hang out for the last time with Graham in L.A. and get badly hooked on second-rate dope. I flee to Switzerland with Anita for a cure, undergo cold turkey horrors, and compose Angie while recovering. When I first saw Nell Cott, I thought that I could probably handle a spell of exile. It was the most amazing house, right at the base of Cap Ferrat, looking out over Villefranche Bay. It had been built around the 1890s by an English banker with a large garden, a little overgrown behind the great iron gates. The proportions were superb. If you felt a little ragged in the morning, you could walk through this glittering chateau and feel restored. It was like a hall of mirrors, with 20-foot ceilings and marble columns, grand staircases. I'd wake up thinking, this is my house? Or about bloody time someone's got it right. This was the grandeur we felt we deserved after the shabbiness of Britain. And since we'd committed ourselves to living abroad, how hard really was it to sit in Nell Cott? We'd been on the road forever. Nell Cott was a lot better than the Holiday Inn. I think everybody felt a sense of liberation compared to what had been going on in England. It was never our intention to record at Nell Cott. We were going to look around for studios in Nice or Cannes, even though the logistics were a little daunting. Charlie Watts had taken a house miles away in the Vaucluse, several hours' drive. Bill Wyman was up in the hills near Grasse. He was soon hanging out with Marc Chagall, of all people. The most unlikely couple I can think of. Bill Wyman and Marc Chagall. Neighbours popped round for a cup of Bill's terrible tea. Mick lived first in the Biblos Hotel in Saint-Tropez, while he waited for his wedding day, then rented a house belonging to Prince Renier's uncle, then a house owned by someone called Madame Tolstoy. Talk about falling in with the cultural Euro-trash, or they with the white trash. They at least welcomed us with open arms. One of the features of Nelcott was a little staircase down to a jetty to which I soon attached the Mandrax II, a very powerful 20-foot motorboat, a Riva, built of mahogany, the creme de la creme of Italian speedboats. Mandrax was an anagram of its original name. All I had to do was knock off a couple of letters and move a couple around. It was irresistible to call it that. I bought it off a guy, renamed it, and set off. No skipper's license or pilot's license. There wasn't even the formal, "Have you ever been on the water before?" Now I'm told you have to take exams to drive a boat in the Mediterranean. It required the companionship of Bobby Keys, not long coming, Graham Parsons, and others to put the Mandrax to the test on the glassy Mediterranean, to strike out for the Riviera and adventure. But this was later. First, there was the matter of Mick's wedding to Bianca, his Nicaraguan fiancée, which came up in May, 4 weeks after our arrival. Marianne had gone from his life in 1970, the previous year, and into the beginning of a lost decade. Mick arranged what he saw as a quiet wedding, for which he chose Saint-Tropez at the height of the season. No journalist stayed at home. In these pre-security days, the couple and the guests wrestled their way through the streets against photographers and tourists, from the church to the mayor's office. Hand-to-hand combat, like trying to get to the bar in a rowdy club. I slid off, leaving Bobby Keys, who was a close friend of Mick's in those days, to act as assistant best man or whatever. Roger Vadim was best man. Bobby's role is mentioned here because Bianca's bridesmaid was the very pretty Nathalie Delon, a strange wife of the French movie star Alain Delon. And Bobby took a great and dangerous fancy to her. She and Delon had been in the center of a scandal that had embroiled the French Prime Minister, Georges Pompidou, and his wife, as well as the crime underworld from Marseille to Paris. Delon's Yugoslav bodyguard, with whom Natalie had had a brief affair, had been shot, his body found in a garbage dump on the outskirts of Paris. No one was ever convicted of killing him. Delon had left Natalie and taken up with the actress Mireille Darc. It was a big mess and wrapped in considerable danger. Behind Delon and Natalie were powerful figures from the Marseille milieu a few miles down the road, as well as a band of Yugoslav toughs. There was clearly a lot of bad feeling and some major political blackmail flying about. Natalie herself had had the wheels loosened on her car. Not a great moment, maybe, to become her new beau. Bobby, knowing nothing of all this, developed an instant fascination with Natalie and blew his heart out at the party that night to attract her attention. He couldn't take his eyes off her. He went back to London before returning to work on the music at Nelcott. And when he got back, Natalie was still there, staying with Bianca. What happened then? Well, they're both still alive as I write, but I'm not sure why. Weeks would pass before that trouble became real. When I slid off at the wedding, it was towards a cubicle in the John of the Biblos. And I'm taking a leak, and in the next cubicle I hear sniffing. "Keep it down," I say, or "break it out." And a voice comes back, "Want some?" And that's how I met Brad Klein, who became a great friend of mine. His forte was transshipment, rerouting dope from here to there. He was a very well-educated, clean-cut-looking boy and used this persona to brass his way through. He did get into dealing coke later and got more involved than he should have, but when I met him, it was the smoke. Brad's dead now. It's the usual old story. If you're dealing in this shit, don't dabble in it. He dabbled, and he always wanted to stay in the game a little longer. But on that day of our meeting, Brad and I went off together to hang and left the wedding to itself. I only got to know the qualities of Bianca later on. Mick never wants me to talk to his women. They end up crying on my shoulder because they found out that he has once again philandered. What am I gonna do? Well, it's a long ride to the airport, honey. Let me think about it. The tears that have been on this shoulder, from Jerry Hall, from Bianca, from Marianne, Chrissy Shrimpton, they've ruined so many shirts of mine. And they ask me what to do. How the hell do I know? I don't fucking. I had Jerry Hall come to me one day with this note from some other chick that was written backwards. Really good code, Mick. I'll be your mistress forever. And all you had to do was hold it up to a mirror to read it. Oh, what a bastard that guy is. And I'm in the most unlikely role of consoler, Uncle Keith. It's a side a lot of people don't connect with me. At first I thought Bianca was just some bimbo. She was also quite aloof for a while, which didn't endear her to anybody around us. But as I got to know her, I discovered that she's bright. And what really impressed me later on, a strong lady. She became a mouthpiece for Amnesty International and a sort of roving ambassador for her own human rights organization, which is some achievement. Very pretty and everything like that, but a very forceful character. No wonder Mick couldn't handle it. The only drawback was that she was never one for a joke. I'm still trying to think of something to make her laugh. If she'd had a sense of humor, I'd have married her. Mick's taking up with Bianca did coincide with our leaving England. So there was a definite schism in place already, a fault line. Bianca brought with her a whole load of baggage and society that Mick got into that nobody was at all interested in, and I've no doubt Bianca by now is no longer interested in either. Even then, I had nothing against her personally. It was just the effect of her and her milieu on Mick that I didn't like. It distanced him from the rest of the band, and Mick's always looking to separate himself from the band. Mick would disappear for 2 weeks on vacation. He would commute from Paris. Bianca was pregnant, and their daughter Jade was born in the fall when Bianca was in Paris. Bianca didn't like Nelcott life, and I don't blame her. So Mick was torn. In those early days at Nelcott, we'd do our promenades down by the harbours, or to the Café Albert in Villefranche, where Anissa would drink her pasties. We were obviously conspicuous in those parts, but we were also pretty hardened and unworried by what people thought. Violence happens when you least expect it, though. Spanish Tony, who came down early on, saved my life a couple of times, either literally or not, and in the town of Beaulieu, on one of those outings near Nelcott, he saved my hide. I had an E-type Jag that I drove down to Beaulieu Harbour with Marlon and Tony aboard, in part in what was pointed out to us by what appeared to be two harbour officials as the wrong place. One came across and said, "Easy," beckoning me and Tony into the harbour office. So Tony and I wandered over, leaving Marlon in the car for what we imagined would be a couple of minutes, and we could see him. Tony smelled it before I did. Two French fishermen, older guys. One had his back to us. He was locking the door, and Tony looked at me. He just said, "Watch my back." He moved like a flash, shoved the chair into my hand, jumped on the table with another chair, and tore into them, splinters everywhere. These guys were whined out of their heads. They'd had a big lunch, some of it still on the table. I just trod on the neck of one of them while Tony did the other one in. Then Tony came back for my one, who was scared shitless. So Tony gave him another smack around the head. "Let's get out of here." Kicked the door open. It was over in a matter of seconds. They're on the floor moaning and whining, claret everywhere, broken furniture. The last thing they were expecting was an assault. They were big sailors, no pussyfooting, and they were going to fuck around with us, slap us about. They were planning to have some fun with the long hairs. Marlin sitting in the Jaguar. "Where you been, Dad?" "Don't worry about it. Vroom, vroom. Let's go." What moves from Spanish Tony? It was a ballet. It was his finest moment. That day, Douglas Fairbanks had nothing on him. It was the swiftest move that I've seen happen, and I've seen a few. I took a lot of leaves out of Tony's book that day. When you smell that trouble coming, act. Don't wait for it to start. 3 days later, cops turned up at the house. They had warrants on me only because Tony wasn't known and had gone back to England by now. A whole lot of rigmarole ran down with examining magistrates, but by the time we got to the second or third level, they realized that these guys didn't have a leg to stand on. When the facts came out that they'd intimidated us, that I'd had a child in the car, that there was no reason for us to be hauled into the office in the first place, suddenly, miraculously, the charges wafted away. I've no doubt it cost me a bit of money with a lawyer, but in the end, these guys chose not to get up in court and say they'd been done in their own office by two insane Englishmen. I was not totally clean when I got to Nelcott, but there's a difference between being not clean and being hooked. Hooked is when you're not going to do anything until you get your hands on the stuff. All your energy goes into that. I brought a small maintenance dose with me, but as far as I was concerned, I just cleaned up. Sometime in May, not that long after our arrival, we went to a go-kart track in Cannes, where my car flipped over on me and rushed me 50 yards down the tarmac on my back, stripping off my skin like bark. I scraped it almost to the bone, and this when I was just about to make a record. All I needed. I was advised by the doctor, "This is going to be very painful, monsieur. The wound must be kept clean. I'll send a nurse to you every day to dress it and check it." There arrived each morning a male nurse, who had been a frontline medic for the French army. He'd been at Dien Bien Phu, the last stand of the French army in Indochina. He'd been in Algeria. He'd seen plentiful blood, and his style was accordingly robust. Little wizened guy, hard as nails. He gave me a shot of morphine each day, and I needed morphine badly. Each time, after he fixed me, he would throw the syringe as a dart, always at the same spot, at a painting, right in the eye. Then, of course, the treatment stopped. But now I'm on the morphine because of this wound, just when I'd cleaned up off the dope. So, first things first, I need some shit. Fat Jack was our cook, who now doubled as the heroin dealer. He was the Marseille connection. He had a bunch of sidekicks, this team of cowboys, who we decided were safer on the payroll than off it, who were good at running errands. Jack emerged because I said, "Who knows how to get some shit around here?" He was young, he was fat, and he was sweaty, and one day he went to Marseille on the train, and he brought back this lovely little bag of white powder and this huge supply, almost the size of a cement bag, of lactose, which was the cut. And he explained to me, in his bad English and my even worse French, he had to write it down, mix 97% lactose with 3% heroin. This heroin was pure. Normally when you bought it, it was pre-mixed, but this stuff you had to mix very precisely. Even at these proportions, it was incredibly powerful. And so I'd be in the bathroom with these scales going 97 to 3. I was scrupulous in my weighing out. You had to be careful. The old lady was taking it, and a couple of other people. 96 to 4, and you could croak on it. One hit of it pure, and boom. Goodbye. There were obvious advantages to buying in such quantity. The price was not phenomenal. It was coming straight from Marseille to Villefranche, just down the road. There were no transport costs, just Jacques' train ticket. The more times you have to score, the more things are likely to screw up. But you also have to really try not to overdo it, because the bigger the score, the more people are interested. Just get enough to get settled for a couple of months, so you don't have to go out and scrabble around for it. This bag, however, never seemed to disappear. Well, once we finish this bag, we can straighten out. Let's put it this way. It lasted from June to November, and we still left some behind. I had to trust the orders that came with it, and they must have been correct, because every time I tried it, it was perfectly fine, and no one complained. I posted the formula on the wall so I wouldn't forget it. 97 to 3. Of course, I thought of writing a song with that title, but then I thought, well, there's no point advertising myself. I would be up there half the afternoon getting it right. I had these great old scales, big brass things, very, very fine, and this big scoop for the lactose. 97 grams. Put that aside, and then you take a little spoon out of the heroin bag, 3 grams. Then you put the two together and mix them up. You've got to shake it. I remember being up there often, so I didn't ever mix a lot together at once. I would do a couple of days' worth, or a little more. We looked at studios in Cannes and elsewhere, reckoned up how much money the French were going to suck out of us. Nelcott had a large basement, and we had our own mobile studio. The Mighty Mobile, as we called it. It was a truck with 8-track recording machines that Stuart helped put together. We thought of it quite separately from any plan to move to France. It was the only independent mobile recording unit around. We didn't realize when we put it together how rare it was. Soon we were renting it out to the BBC and ITV because they only had one apiece. It was another one of those beautiful, graceful, fortuitous things that happened to the Stones. So one day in June, it trundled through the gates and we parked it outside the front door and plugged in. I've never done any different since. When you've got the equipment and the right guys, you don't need anything else in terms of studios. Only Mick still thinks you have to take things into real recording studios to really make a real record. He got proved totally wrong on our latest, at the time of writing, album. A bigger bang, especially because we did it all in his little chateau in France. We had got the stuff worked up, and he said, now we'll take it into a real recording studio. And Don Was and I looked at each other, and Charlie looked at me. Fuck this shit. We've already got it down, right here. Why do you want to spring for all that bread? So you can say it was cut in so-and-so's studio, the glass wall and the control room? We ain't going nowhere, pal. So, finally, he relented. The basement in Nelcott was big enough, but it was divided into a series of bunkers. Not a great deal of ventilation, hence ventilator blues. The weirdest thing was trying to find out where you'd left the saxophone player. Bobby Keys and Jim Price moved around to where they could get their sound right, mostly standing with their backs to the wall at the end of a narrow corridor, where Dominic Tarlay took one of his pictures of them with microphone cables snaking away around a corner. Eventually, we ended up painting the microphone cable to the horn section yellow. If you wanted to talk to the horns, you followed the yellow cable until you found them. You wouldn't know where the hell you were. It was an enormous house. Sometimes Charlie would be in a room, and I'd have to tramp a quarter of a mile to find him. But considering that it was basically a dungeon, it was fun to work there. All the characteristics of that basement were discovered by the other guys. For the first week or so, we didn't know where Charlie was set up because he'd be trying different cubicles every night. Jimmy Miller encouraged him to try down the end of the corridor, but Charlie said, "I'm half a mile down that damn road. It's too far away. I need to be closer." So he had to check out every little cubicle. You didn't want to add electronic echo unless you had to. You wanted natural echo, and down there you found some really weird ones. I played guitar in a room with tiles, turning the amp round and pointing it at the corner of the room to see what got picked up on the microphone. I remember doing that for Rocks Off, maybe Rip This Joint. But as weird as it was to record there, especially at the beginning, by the time we were into it, within a week or two, it was totally natural. There was no talk amongst the band or with Jimmy Miller or the engineer Andy Johns. What a weird way to make a record. No, we've got it. All we've got to do is persevere. We would record from late in the afternoon until 5 or 6 in the morning. And suddenly the dawn comes up, and I've got this boat. Go down the steps through the cave to the dockside. Let's take mandrakes to Italy for breakfast. We just jump in, Bobby Keys, me, Mick, whoever was up for it. Most days we would go down to Monton, an Italian town just inside France by some quirk of treaty making, or just beyond it to Italy proper. No passport. Right past Monte Carlo as the sun's coming up with music ringing in our ears. Take a cassette player and play something we've done. Play that second mix. Just pull up at the wharf and have a nice Italian breakfast. We like the way the Italians cook their eggs and the bread. And with the fact that you had actually crossed a border and nobody knew shit or did shit about it, it was an extra sense of freedom. We play the mix to the Italians, see what they thought. If we hit the fishermen at the right time, we could get Red Snapper straight off the boats and take it home for lunch. We pull into Monte Carlo for lunch, have a chat with either Onassis' lot or Niarchos's, who had the big yachts there. You could almost see the guns pointed at each other. That's why we called it Exile on Main Street. When we first came up with the title, it worked in American terms because everybody's got a Main Street. But our Main Street was the Riviera Strip. And we were exiles. So it rang perfectly true and said everything we needed. The whole Mediterranean coast was an ancient connection of its own. A kind of Main Street without borders. I've hung in Marseille, and it was all it was cracked up to be, and I've no doubt it still is. It's like the capital of a country that embraces the Spanish coast, the North African coast, the whole Mediterranean coast. It's basically a country all its own until a few miles inland. Everybody that lives on the coast, fishermen, sailors, smugglers, belongs to an independent community, including The Greeks, the Turks, the Egyptians, the Tunisians, the Libyans, the Moroccans, the Algerians, and the Jews. It's an old connection that can't be broken by borders and countries. We'd piss about. We'd go to Antibes. We used to go to Saint-Tropez to score all the bitches. This boat could kick through. It had a big engine. And the Mediterranean, when it's smooth, is a quick ride. The summer of 71 was one of those Mediterranean summers where every day was perfect. You hardly needed to know any navigation. You just followed the coastline. I never had charts. And Nietzsche refused ever to board this boat on the grounds of my lack of familiarity with the submerged rocks. She would wait and watch for the distress flares as we ran out of petrol. I just figured if they could get an aircraft carrier into the damn bay, I should be able to navigate it. The only bit I did check out was the landing, the dockside. Land is always the dangerous thing for a boat. The only time I thought about the actual art of boatmanship was docking. Otherwise, it was a laugh. Villefranche Harbour is very deep and was a big hang for the American Navy. One day, suddenly, there was this huge aircraft carrier in the middle of the bay. The Navy on a courtesy call. They did all the flag waving around the Mediterranean during the summer. And as we were pulling away from our dock, we got this whiff of marijuana on a large scale, blowing out the portholes. Out of their brains. I had Bobby Keys with me, so we went to have breakfast, and when we came back, we circled around the aircraft carrier, and there were all these sailors there who were glad they weren't in Vietnam. And I was in my little mandrax, and we sniffed. Oh, hi, guys. I smell... And they threw us a bag of weed. And in exchange, we told them... which were the best whorehouses in town. Coco Bar, the Brass Ring was a good one. When the fleet was in, all these damn dark streets in Villefranche would suddenly burst with lighting as if it were Las Vegas. It's the Cafe Dakota or the Nevada Bar. They put anything that sounded American on it. The Texan Hang. The streets of Villefranche would come alive with neon and fairy lights. All the bitches from Nice would come in, and Monte Carlo, all the whores from Cannes. The crew of an aircraft carrier is 2,000-odd men, randy and ready to serve. It was enough to attract the whole south coast. Otherwise, when they weren't in town, Villefranche was dead as a doornail. It's amazing that the music we made down in that basement is still going, given that the record wasn't even that highly rated when it first came out. The outtakes of Exile on Main Street were released as part of a reissue in 2010. The music was recorded in 1971, nearly 40 years ago as I write. If I had been listening to music that was 40 years old in 1971, I would have been listening to stuff that was barely recordable. Maybe some early Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton. I suppose a world war in between changes the perception. Rocks off, happy, ventilator blues, tumbling dice, all down the line. That's five string. Open tuning to the max. I was starting to really fix my trademark. I wrote all that stuff within a few days. Suddenly, with the five string, songs were just dripping off my fingers. My first real exercise on five string was Honky Tonk Women a couple of years before. At that time, it was, oh, this is interesting. There was Brown Sugar, too, which came out the month we quit England. By the time we got to working on Exile, I was really starting to find all these other moves and how to make minor chords and suspended chords. I discovered that the five string becomes very interesting when you add a capo. This limits your room to maneuver drastically, especially if you place the capo up on the fifth or the seventh fret. But also, it gives a certain ring, a certain resonance, that can't be obtained really any other way. But it's when to use it and when not to overdo it. If it's mixed song to start with, I won't start it off with five string. I'll start on a regular tuning and just learn it or feel my way around it, classico style. And then if Charlie ups the rhythm a little bit or gives it a different feel, I'll say, let me put this to five string for a moment and just see how that alters the structure of the thing. Obviously, doing that simplifies the sound in that you're limiting yourself to a set thing. But if you find the right one, like Start Me Up, it creates the song. I've heard millions of bands try and play Start Me Up with regular tuning. It just won't work, pal. We brought a lot of stuff to Nelcott that had been incubating for a while. I would farm out the title or the idea. This is called All Down the Line, Mick. I hear it coming all down the line. Off you go. I was coming up with a couple of new songs a day, and one would work and one wouldn't. Mick kept up with the writing at this phenomenal pace. Very canny rock and roll lyrics, with those catchy phrases and repetitions. All Down the Line came directly out of Brown Sugar, which Mick wrote. Most of what I had to do was to come up with riffs and ideas that would turn Mick on, to write songs he could handle. They had to be good records, but translatable to being played on stage. I was the butcher, cutting the meat. And sometimes he didn't like it. He didn't like Rip This Joint. It was too fast. I think we might have popped it once since then, but Rip This Joint, in terms of beats per minute, is something like a world record. Maybe Little Richard had done something faster, but in any case, nobody was looking to beat the world record. Some of the titles of the songs we wrote that never made it onto the album are bizarre. Head in the Toilet Blues, Leather Jackets, Windmill. I Was Just a Country Boy. Dancing in the Light, that must have been one of Mick. Bent Green Needles, Labour Pains, Pomme de Terre. Well, we were in France at the time. We wrote Torn and Frayed, which is not often played and has some topical interest. Joe's Got a Cough sounds kind of rough. Yeah, and the codeine to fix it. Doctor prescribes, drugstore supplies. Who's going to help him to kick it? Apart from Sister Morphine and a few odd references to coke, we never really wrote songs about drugs. They would only crop up in songs as they did in life, here and there. There were always rumors and folklore about songs, who they were written for, what they were really about. Flash was supposed to be about heroin, and I see the connotation, the reference to Jack. But Jumping Jack Flash has nothing to do with heroin. The myths go deep, though. Whatever you write, somebody is going to interpret in some other way, see codes buried in the lyrics. That's why you have conspiracy theories. Somebody croaked, oh my God, who are they going to blame this one on, you know, when the guy just keeled over. The lifeblood of good conspiracies is that you'll never find out. The lack of evidence keeps them fresh. No one's ever going to find out if I had my blood changed or not. The story is well beyond the reach of evidence, or, if it never happened, my denials. But then, listen on, I've stood back for many years from honestly addressing that burning topic. Tumbling Dice may have had something to do with the gambling den that Nelcott turned into. There were car games and roulette wheels, Monte Carlos around the corner. Bobby Keys and Cats did go down there once or twice. We did play dice. I credit Mick with Tumbling Dice, but the song had to make the transition from its earlier form, which was a song called Good Time Women. You might have all of the music, a great riff, but sometimes the subject matter is missing. It only takes one guy sitting around a room saying, "Throwing craps last night," for a song to be born. Got to roll me. Songs are strange things. Little notes like that. If they stick, they stick. With most of the songs I've ever written, quite honestly, I felt there's an enormous gap here waiting to be filled. This song should have been written hundreds of years ago. How did nobody pick up on that little space? Half the time, you're looking for gaps that other people haven't done. And you say, "I don't believe they've missed that fucking hole. It's so obvious. It was there staring you in the face." I pick out the holes. I realize now that Exile was made under very chaotic circumstances, and with innovative ways of recording, but those seem to be the least of the problems. The most pressing problem was, do we have songs? And do we get the sound? Anything else that went on was peripheral. You can hear a load of my outtakes ending, "Oh well, run out, that's the story so far." But you'd be surprised. When you're put right on the ball and you've got to do something, and everybody's looking at you going, "Okay, what's gonna happen?" You put yourself up there on the firing line. Give me a blindfold and a last cigarette, and let's go. And you'd be surprised how much comes out of you before you die. Especially when you're fooling the rest of the band, who think you know exactly what you're going to do, and you know you're blind as a bat and have no idea. But you're just going to trust yourself. Something's going to come. You come out with one line, throw in a guitar line, and then another line's got to come out. This is where supposedly your talent lies. It's not in trying to meticulously work out how to build a Spitfire. Maybe I would crash out, if I crashed out at all, around 10 in the morning, get up around 4 in the afternoon, subject to the usual variations. Nobody's going to arrive until sunset anyway. So then I had a couple of hours to think about or play back what we did last night so I could pick it up where we left off. Or, if we had it already, it was a matter of what to do when the guys arrived a little later. And you sometimes start to panic when you realize you have nothing to offer them. It's always that feeling when these guys are expecting material as if it comes from the gods, whereas the reality is, it comes from Mick and me. When you see the documentary on Exile, it gives an impression of jamming away spontaneously for hours in the bunker until we've got something, until we're ready to go for a take, as if we're trusting to incoming from the ether. That's the way it's been portrayed, and some of it might have happened that way, but ask Mick. He and I would look at each other. What do we give them today? What ammo do we put in today, baby? Because we know everybody's going to go along with this. As long as there's a song, there's something to play. We might have occasionally lapsed and decided to overdub something we did yesterday, but basically, Mick and I both felt it was our duty to come up with a new song, a new riff, a new idea or two, preferably. We were prolific. We felt then that it was impossible that we couldn't come up with something every day or every 2 days. That was what we did. And even if it was the bare bones of a riff, it was something to go on. And then while they're trying to get the sound on it, or we're trying to shape the riff, the song would fall into place of its own volition. Once you're on a roll with the first few chords, the first idea of the rhythm, You can figure out other things, like doesn't need a bridge in the middle, later. It was living on a knife edge as far as that's concerned. There was no preparation. But that's not the point. That's rock and roll. The idea is to make the bare bones of a riff, snap the drums in, and see what happens. And it was the immediacy of it that, in retrospect, made it even more interesting. There was no time for too much reflection, for ploughing the field twice. It was, it goes like this, and see what comes out. And this is when you realize that with a good band, you only really need a little sparkle of an idea, and before the evening's over, it will be a beautiful thing. We did dry up. Casino Boogie came out of when Mick and I had just about run ourselves ragged. Mick's looking at me, and I go, oh, I don't know. And it came to my mind, the old Bill Burrows cut-up method. Let's rip headlines out of newspapers and pages out of a book, and then throw them on the floor and see what comes up. Hey, we're obviously in no mood to write a song in the usual fashion, so let's use somebody else's method. And it worked on Casino Boogie. I'm surprised we haven't used it since, quite honestly. But at that time, it was desperation. One phrase bounces off another, and suddenly it makes sense, even though they're totally disconnected, but they have the same feel about them, which is a fair definition of writing a rock or pop lyric anyway. Grotesque music, million-dollar sad, got no tactics, got no time on hand, left shoe shuffle, right shoe muffle, sinking in the sand. Fade out freedom, steaming heat on, watch that hat in black. Finger twitching. Got no time on hand. I remember being a little dismayed that Charlie had decided to live 3 hours away. I would have loved to have Charlie around the corner so I could call him and say, got an idea, can you pop by? But the way Charlie wanted to live, and where he wanted to live, was in fact about 130 miles away, in the Vaucluse, above Aix-en-Provence. So he would come down from Monday till Friday. So then I had him there, but I could have used a little more. And Mick was a lot of the time in Paris. The only thing I was afraid of on exile was that, with people living so far away, it would break their concentration. And once I got them there, I wanted them for the duration. I'd never lived on top of the work before, but once I was, I said, damn it, the rest of you better get used to it, fuck it, I'm doing it, and I've committed my house to it. If I can do it, you can all get a little closer. To Charlie, it was an absolute no-no. He has an artistic temperament. It's just uncool for him to live down on the Côte d'Azur in summer. Too much society going on, and too much blah, blah. I can understand, totally. Charlie's the kind of guy that would go down in winter when it's horrible and empty. He found where he wanted to live, and it certainly wasn't on the coast. And it certainly wasn't Cannes, Nice, Juan-les-Pins, Cap Ferrat, or Monte Carlo. Charlie cringes from places like that. One sublime example of a song winging in from the ether is Happy. We did that in an afternoon, in only 4 hours, cut and done. At noon, it had never existed. At 4 o'clock, it was on tape. It was no Rolling Stones record. It's got the name on it, but it was actually Jimmy Miller on drums, Bobby Keys on baritone, and that was basically it. And then I overdubbed bass and guitar. We were just waiting for everybody to turn up for the real sessions for the rest of the night, and we thought, we're here, let's see if we can come up with something. I'd written it that day. We got something going, we were rocking, everything was set up, and so he said, well, let's start to work it down, and then we'll probably hit it with the guys later. I decided to go on the five string with the slide, and then suddenly, there it was. Just like that. By the time they got there, we had it. Once you have something, you just let it fly. Well, I never kept a dollar past sunset. I always burn a hole in my pants. Never made a school mama happy. Never blew the second chance. Oh, no. I need a love to keep me happy. It just came, tripping off the tongue then and there. When you're writing this shit, you've got to put your face in front of the microphone, spit it out. Something will come. I wrote the verses of Happy, but I don't know where they came from. Never got a lift out of Learjet. When I can fly way back home, it was just alliteration. Just trying to set up a story. There has to be some thin plot line. Although, in a lot of my songs, well, you'd be very hard-pressed to find it. But here, you're broke, and it's evening. And you want to go out, but you ain't got shit. I'm busted before I start. I need a love to keep me happy. Because if it's real love, it will be free. Don't have to pay for it. I need a love to keep me happy. Because I've spent the fucking money, and I have none left. And it's night time, and I'm looking to have a good time, but I ain't got shit. So, I need love to keep me happy. Baby, baby, won't you keep me happy? I'd have been happier if more came like happy. It goes like this. Great songs write themselves. You're just being led by the nose or the ears. The skill is not to interfere with it too much. Ignore intelligence. Ignore everything. Just follow it where it takes you. You really have no say in it. And then suddenly, there it is. Oh, I know how this goes. And you can't believe it because you think that nothing comes like that. You think, where did I steal this from? No, no, that's original. Well, about as original as I can get. And you realize that songs write themselves. You're just the conveyor. Not to say that I haven't labored. Some of them had us on our knees. Some are about 35 years old, and I've not quite finished them yet. You can write the song, but that's not the whole deal. The thing is, what kind of sound, what tempo, what key, and is everybody really into it? Tumbling Dice took a few days to get right. I remember working on that intro for several afternoons. When you're listening to music, you can tell how much calculation has gone into it and how much is free flow. You can't do the free flow all the time. And it's really a matter of how much calculation and how little you can put into it, rather than the other way round. Well, I've got to tame this beast one way or another, but how to tame it? Gently or give it a beating? I'll fuck you up. I'll take you twice the speed I wrote you. You have this sort of relationship with the songs. You talk to the fuckers. You ain't finished till you're finished, okay? All that sort of shit. No, you weren't supposed to go there. Or sometimes, you're apologizing. I'm sorry about that. No, that was certainly not the way to go. Ah, they're funny things. They're babies. But a song should come from the heart. I never had to think about it. I just pick up the guitar, go to the piano, and let the stuff come to me. Something would arrive, incoming. And if it didn't, I'd play somebody else's songs. And I've never really had to get to the point of saying, I'm now going to write a song. I've never ever done that. When I first knew I could do it, I wondered if I could do another one. And then I found they were rolling off my fingers like pearls. I never had any difficulty in writing songs. It was a sheer pleasure, and a wonderful gift that I didn't know I had. It amazes me. Sometime in July, Gram Parsons came to Nellcote with Gretchen, his young bride-to-be. He was already working on the songs for his first solo record, GP. I'd been hanging with him for a couple of years by then, and I just had the feeling that this man was about to come out with something remarkable. In fact, he changed the face of country music, and he wasn't around long enough to find out. He recorded his first masterpieces with Emmylou Harris a year later, with Streets of Baltimore, A Song for You, That's All It Took, We'll Sweep Out the Ashes in the Morning. Whenever we were together, we played. We played all the time. We'd write stuff. We'd work together in the afternoons, sing Everly Brothers songs. It's hard to describe how deeply Gram loved his music. It was all he lived for. And not just his own music, but music in general. He'd be like me. Wake up with George Jones, roll over, and wake up again to Mozart. I absorbed so much from Gram, that Bakersfield way of turning melodies and also lyrics different from the sweetness of Nashville, the tradition of Merle Haggard and Buck Owens, the blue-collar lyrics from the immigrant world of the farms and oil wells of California. At least that's where it had its origins in the 50s and 60s. That country influence came through in the Stones. You can hear it in Dead Flowers, Torn and Frayed, Sweet Virginia, and Wild Horses, which we gave to Gram to put on the Flying Burrito Brothers record, Burrito Deluxe, before we put it out ourselves. We had plans, or at least great expectations, Gram and I. You work with somebody that good, and you think, we've got years, man. No rush. Where's the fire? We can put some really good stuff together, and you expect it to evolve. Once we get over the next cold turkey, we'll really come out with some good shit. We thought we had all the time in the world. Mick resented Gram Parsons. It took me a long time to discover that people around me were much more conscious of this than I was. They describe how he made life uncomfortable for Gram, hitting on Gretchen to put pressure on him, making it plain he wasn't welcome. Stanley Booth remembers Mick being like a tarantula around Gram. That I was writing and playing with somebody else seemed to him to be a betrayal, though he could never put it in those terms. And it never occurred to me at the time. I'm just expanding my club. I'm getting around, meeting people. But it didn't stop Mick from sitting around and playing and singing with Gram. That's all you wanted to do around Gram. It would just be song. After song, after song. Gram and Gretchen left under some bad feeling. Although it must be said that Gram wasn't in great physical shape, I really don't remember the circumstances of his departure clearly. I'd insulated myself against the dramas of the crowded household. I've no doubt, in retrospect, that Mick was very jealous of me having other male friends. And I've no doubt that that was more of a difficulty than women or anything else. It took me a long time to realize that any male friend I had would automatically get the cold shoulder or at least a suspicious reception from Mick. Any guys I got close to would tell me, sooner or later, I don't think Mick likes me. Mick and I were very tight friends, and we'd been through a lot. But there is a weird possessiveness about him. It was only a vague aura to me, but other people pointed it out. Mick doesn't want me to have any friends except him. Maybe his exclusivity is bound up with his own siege mentality. Or maybe he thinks he's trying to protect me. What does that asshole want from Keith? But quite honestly, I can't put my finger on it. People he thought were getting close to me, he would preempt them, or try to, as if they were girlfriends rather than just friends. But back then with Graham, was Mick feeling excluded? It wouldn't have occurred to me at the time. Everybody was moving around, meeting different people, and experiencing things. And I don't know if Mick would even agree with this, but I have the feeling that Mick thought that I belonged to him, and I didn't feel like that at all. It's taken me years to even think about that idea, because I love the man dearly. I'm still his mate, but he makes it very difficult to be